Okay, I'd like to welcome you to the Faculty of Education today. It's great to see lots of you interested in studying education at Cambridge. So this is the first of our sample lectures. So I'd like to introduce Dr. David Whitley, one of our Directors of Studies in Education. His background is in literature, including tutoring medieval literature at Oxford, and spent time working with emotionally disturbed adolescents as well. His current teaching focuses on poetry, film, children's literature, and looking at these in an interdisciplinary way. This sample lecture hopefully give you a flavour of just how broad studying education can be, that it's not just about teaching people. All of these issues can be covered within the education tripos. So I'm going to hand you over now to David.
Great, thank you very much. As Jackie says, this introductory lecture, or specimen lecture, teaser I think they call them in the United States, is designed to show something of the breadth of the ways in which learning and education are interpreted within the faculty, and also some of the kind of opportunities for probing the concept of what happens when we learn through different contexts in a whole rich variety of different ways. So I'm going to start with a clip of a film, the reasons for which will become more obvious as I extrapolate on it later on. This is a popular animation film from the Pixar Disney stable. A number of you may have seen it. It came out in 2008 and is called WALL-E. For those who haven't, just for a little bit of context, the clip I want to show comes from very near the start of the film, and the premise of the film, which is unusually for films all directed towards children, or a kind of children's film literature genre, takes its influences from particularly the dystopian science fiction films of the 1970s, some of which were extraordinarily bleak. The early 1970s, for whatever reason, seemed to be a time when there was pessimism mixed with the optimism of the 60s, largely. And the future, these were explorations of a future which looked pretty bleak. The film takes, as I say, its influences from that, and it imagines an Earth when, as one can do in science fiction films, you extrapolate some of the tendencies that are there in an existing society and see what they might look like if they were allowed to run, develop, and go rampant, as it were, into a future, and you've selected them out, as it were, as being core determinants of future experience. So this projection of the future based on a premise that our current consumer society and the ways that we throw away waste afterwards has reached apocalyptic dimensions, and the Earth has literally become one enormous rubbish tip within which all life forms are choked off effectively, and human beings have had to go migrate to a spaceship in order to live and leave the planet Earth behind. All that's left on Earth is a remarkable little robot, the eponymous WALL-E, whose programmed task to continue to collect waste and organize it in piles, he's continued to carry out, and he's got an energy supply through solar panels on him, which enables him to do that. So we're just going to start by having a look at the opening scene, which I'll extrapolate on a bit later and tell you something about the focus of the talk. I might actually, I don't know if, could you hit the light? Thanks, Kenichi. Thank you. Okay, we'll leave Wally there. He's experiencing what philosophers call a category problem at the end, in terms of selecting where to put the fork, in terms of his imagination. In presenting that clip, I'm obviously opening up a particular example of a film, but I want to look at it from the point of view of raising a larger question, or give it, show it as an example of how we might explore a larger question, which is the question about what is it that we learn, not just in the institutional context which are dedicated towards our learning, but from the wider environment, which perhaps is equally, perhaps even more important than institutions like schools and universities where we learn. And I want to pose the question particularly, what do we learn from art or various forms of art? This clip, which is from the popular cinema, poses the question, I think, in particularly interesting kinds of ways, and meshes with an area which I'm especially interested in, which is environmental consciousness and education, obviously in its more formal aspects. So that's the larger question that I want to mesh this with. It's perhaps worth saying, perhaps just from the outset, that it's traditional here to see children, art for children and for young readers, as having a more didactic intention declared within it, often, than more adult forms of art. So some art, at least, is declaring its intentions or has, tries consciously, as it were, to teach children something. And in some ways, the film of Wall-E, you could see as being a film with a message. It's dystopian. In other words, it's showing something which could happen in the future, playing out possibilities, but you could also read it or understand it as being a kind of cautionary tale. In writing large, the repercussions of following a curve of consumer society to its logical endpoint, we perceive a society which has gone seriously awry. And the film is a kind of fable in some ways, which shows how regenerative impulses might recover something of a genuine humanity and a better relationship with the earth at the other end of it. So one reason for choosing this film is that it's got credentials, as it were, as an instrument for teaching something in a traditional sort of way. It's a moral fable, if you like, addressing many of the issues of our time. However, I want to argue, or perhaps get us thinking, about a sense that art is not obviously just functional in terms of the message that it has. And if we look at what we learn from different forms of art, it's not simply that we get a memorable or vivid form of a message inculcated into us. I want to look at some of the multiple dimensions within which what I think is in popular cinema, but really quite one of the great films, really, of the 21st century, what it offers, as it were, in terms of readers' experience, young readers' experience, at different kinds of levels. So that's the purpose of the talk, and there I am, introducing myself and the title at the beginning. This was a paper I gave for a conference last summer. I've sort of adapted it slightly for purpose. Okay, so let's pose this question in a number of different ways. I want to open it up through some of the thinkers who've done thinking about what film is about and what it means. And my opening quotation is from one of the great early philosophers of the cinema, a French theorist called André Bazin, who wrote really quite seminal books and articles under the title What is Cinema? Raising the big philosophical question about it. And the last bit of the quotation here is a claim: our experience of space is the structural basis for our concept of the universe. Our experience of space is the structural basis for our concept of the universe. Now, like many philosophers' gnomic pronouncements, you're not quite sure when you read them, first of all, whether this is the most profound thing you've ever read or whether it's blindingly obvious. I think it's a rather lovely sentence and it's worth meditating on over a period of time. But in some ways, I guess we could say, yes, of course we're connected to the universe through our sense of the space that surrounds us. But should we not be thinking about that as philosophers do? And what does cinematic space have to tell us about that? The way space is designed to be meaningful in different ways under the auspices of the camera. I want to take this into the film of Wall-E and take this concept of space and explore it in a little bit more depth. Wall-E is, again, a very interesting example because, in a sense, it constructs its narrative around two spaces, two distinctive spaces. One is the space of the Earth, you know, which has become is subject to what's sometimes called the apocalypse of trash. It's completely overwhelmed by consumer products and is being literally dehumanized. And that you might call its dystopian space. The other space is the space of the spaceship Axiom, where, as you see in the advertisement still flickering up 700 years on after the Earth's been deserted at the beginning of the film, is presented as being an alluring space, something that might attract human beings and indeed tempt them away from Earth as a sort of escape route. So through its advertising filter, we might suggest that the spaceship Axiom is a kind of utopian space. You know, it's something the sort of space that we might imagine and desire as being something that we really want for ourselves. In the film, though, of course, it's not utopian, it's anti-utopian. It's got elements in it, as it were, which undercut that. So these two spaces are really interesting, particularly in terms of the way that they're offered comparatively with each other. We read the film, as it were, we understand the film through the evaluations, the perhaps constantly changing evaluations that we make about the significance of these two spaces. Have a look at these still images, and perhaps we can explore something in more depth about the nature of these spaces. This is the control room of the spaceship Axiom, although we discover in the course of the film that this captain of the ship is not actually in control of it. It's controlled by the programming operations, which the multinational company, by and large, have left behind, and he has very little to do with what happens on it. It's, in some ways, an alluring kind of space, though, isn't it? Its dominant tone is blue, the colour that you get saturating the newsroom when you see it on the television for particular sorts of reasons. That blue saturation is supposed to denote some kind of authority. It's cool in both senses of the word. And it also makes people feel more at peace in some sort of way. So it's part of its alluring quality. It's a highly designed space, isn't it? It's got lots of smooth surfaces on it, colours which draw attention to themselves, but in a way which is designed to be relatively pleasing to the eye. And it's a space which epitomises experience as design, which, of course, many firms, including the big firm Apple, sell themselves on that cool designed space which they offer to consumers. Of course, Pixar's founder, Steve Jobs, has also had a kind of moonlighting job with the Apple Corporation as well. So I'm not suggesting there's product placement going on in there, but there's something of an affiliation, as it were, between this anti-utopian space and the kind of designer job that Apple does. If we move on and have a look at the inner space of Axiom, this looks like, superficially, like a brochure that you might get for going on holiday to the Med or something. Again, it's cooled down in terms of its colour hues, in terms of this dominant blue mode. As you look at it more closely, though, you realise there are some things which play towards its anti-utopian, not its desirable utopian sort of end. These curious spiky things coming up in the middle are holograms of palm trees. And of course, in this world, this designed world completely dominated by artifice and having lost touch with nature, this attenuated image of the palm tree is all that's left of our connection to the natural world. And as we realise that, I guess we start to think, oh, this is a space of loss, not of fulfilled pleasure. And again, the space is constituted, isn't it, by, it looks like people are relaxing and having a wonderful time. None of them are looking at each other. They're all looking at screens. No one's attention is directed towards other human beings. It's all mediated through the screen. So we notice a kind of extrapolation of what you might call a social tendency that we're all very aware of, which is that we spend more and more of our time caught up in terms of our attention and consciousness with screens in front of us. And parents like myself who regularly berate their children for doing text messages when you're trying to talk to them, which is a very annoying thing to do, annoying for them as well as for me, are all too aware of the allure and the temptations, as it were, of prioritising screen over actuality. And of course, it's a theme which we're already aware of in our society. Here we've writ it so large that people no longer actually even look at each other, and if they're communicating with each other, they do so via the screen medium. If you think that's bizarrely futuristic, and perhaps I should say that at a recent conference I went to, a fellow academic shared with me that she and her husband, who were both academics, worked really hard into the evening, and if they wanted to have a good chat, one of them was on a computer upstairs and one downstairs, and they simply had a chat emailing each other rather than going downstairs and having a cup of tea. So it's not quite as ridiculous as it might appear. I mean, obviously, it's a tendency which has been pushed in a particular sort of direction. You might also notice that though people seem to be enjoying themselves and relaxed, obviously they're hugely overweight. So the other tendency it's picking up is our modern society, which tends to induce in children especially, but you know, lifelong, a sense that it's more difficult in our society to naturally get exercise than it would have been in previous existing societies. The anxiety around obeseness is writ large with these figures out in space who've lost all their muscle tone and muscle use, and indeed are completely dependent on the technology of the chair in order to move around. And of course the space is organised, isn't it? Subtly. It looks quite relaxed, these circles around the pool, but you know, they're highly organised. It's not quite the Chinese army or display before the Olympics coming out with its highly organised patterns, but it's subtly got a kind of sense of that within itself. And here are these lines going up and down to the pool. So this looks like a control sort of space as well as other things. So there's some probings, as it were, of these polarised spaces going on here. That's perhaps one dimension that we might feel, well, we're learning something from this film. It's sharpening our awareness of our own space, you know, by over-emphasising it, putting it in a more dramatic form than we see it already, and opening that up for our own reflection and thought. Here's the space on Earth, which I've suggested is dystopian, and of course it looks like a rubbish tip. However, it has this figure, Wally, in it, who is programmed functionally to pick up the rubbish, but he's also, I guess the premise or the conceit of the film is that his robotic programming has evolved almost in a sort of Darwinian way, as though he were an organism over the years that he's been doing it, and he's acquired, as it were, a set of characteristics which we would think of as being more human in nature. He's interested in the things which he picks up, some of them. He collects them, you know, like a child, really, you know, who collects lots of odd things, who often collect lots of odd things that their parents or adults think are completely useless and not even worthy of attention, and often put them together in a special place that they have, which is indeed Wally's den, where he has things which are practical for him, where he can repair himself. But he has a whole set of things like this 1960s hubcap that he picks up because the thing focuses his attention. So there's another sort of narrative underneath this Earth space, you know, which looks rubbish first of all, which is that unlike the designer smooth, cool space of Axiom, it remains textured. It has variety in it, but it's variety, as it were, which isn't there in the dominant colour tone. It looks quite monochrome in some ways, but it's there in terms of the probing of it. A childlike consciousness can find things in this and can re-examine them, revalue them, as it were, in their own terms. So the film, in a way, through this particular space, is also modelling a certain kind of behaviour, a certain kind of attention, which is more open, more childlike than adults might have, but also in that sense offers a regenerative capacity. And that's one of the things where, you know, the film offers a way of learning. So the filmmakers were quite aware of this. They wanted to adjust the way that the Earth scene was seen so that, as it says at the end, it looks dirty, but just enough that a kid would still want to go there and play. It's a textured dirt. It's not a uniform sort of dirt. It appeals to a child imagination. Okay, so that's one element, probing the notion of space. Let's take another angle on it, which is a current theme within environmental philosophers, perhaps within environmental education as well. This theme has to do with our own attentiveness to modes of communication going on. Now, over the last few years, perhaps the last few decades especially, you could suggest that there's been almost an exponential increase in the number and forms of technologically directed modes of communication, you know, that we have accessibility to, and that indeed take up quite a lot of our time in terms of the way that we communicate with each other. You know, we have mobile phones, we have text messaging, et cetera, and various sort of forms within those platforms where they continually seem to slightly exponentially generate new forms of things, so that people obviously spend huge amounts of time either watching television or on screens or doing things with mobile phones. These are all modes of communication whereby we, as it were, get in touch with each other. They're communicating to other human agents, as it were. And our attention is directed along those channels. We don't think about it, but it's very human directed. If you put yourself back 100 or 200 years, particularly perhaps outside of an urban setting, obviously none of these technological forms would be available to you. One can pose the question, what sorts of communication would you be in touch with? And how many forms of communication other than purely human ones would you be aware of and would you enfold into your consciousness? And this is the last bit of what I think Sean Cubitt's rather beautiful rendition of this, where he says that human communication is only comprehensible in relation to the universe of communication that enfolds, contains, and speaks with it. In other words, to be fully human, we need to realize how our own communication takes place in a universe of other communications going on around it. Our 18th century person, or slightly later, perhaps in a rural setting, would be keenly aware of the way cows communicated on the farm. You know, they would be listening out for the fox's call, who might take their chickens. They would know many of the individual species of birds and the kinds of communicative sounds that they made in birdsong, etc., etc. In other words, their attunement, you would be to something of that universe of communication, including non-human communication, that Cubitt refers to here, and not to what looks like an amplification, but looked at from another angle, might look like a narrowing of our sphere of communication, so that we become perhaps overly centered on the purely human mediated through technological forms. So that's a kind of eco-critical sort of perspective on this. I'll add to that Val Plumwood, who's an Australian philosopher, environmental philosopher, who died about 5 years ago, her statement about our general openness or capacity for openness to the non-human other as potentially an intentional and communicative being, the non-human other, all the organic animal forms that surround us. They say in cities you can never be more than 2 meters away from a rat, for instance, but Fortunately, few of us think about that most of the time, and we don't listen to rats communicating in the sewers underneath of us. But their presence is there. Indeed, it's another interesting theme that our big cities, you have become sites in which new forms of animals have started to gain access to more. You know, you get peregrine falcons in the middle of London breeding there now and taking the pigeons and so on. Wolves and bears and foxes and so on regularly come into big American and Canadian cities. So the expulsion of organic life forms from cities seems to have started another sort of wave whereby perhaps, you know, life forms are coming back in other ways. And even in Britain, you'll no doubt be aware that you see foxes regularly in the daytime in cities now where you would never have seen them 20 or 30 years ago. So an interesting relationship there. Plumwood calls this stance, listening to the other, not just our fellow human beings, the attentiveness stance. And she thinks that cultivating it is a key aspect, you know, to developing a deeper, more resonant kind of environmental consciousness, not just listening to dire warnings about climate change, but attuning ourselves to a world around us in less narrow ways than perhaps we're encouraged to do by our culture. Now, again, Wally, one could argue, models something of Plumwood's attentiveness stance to some degree also Cubitt's sense of our being enfolded in a universe of communication, not just human-based communication. Wall-E is a remarkable film and a rather daring film in some ways in terms of modern cinema for young adults and children, in that it takes a risk that for its first 25 minutes it has virtually no verbal communication, human verbal communication going on. There's the advert which has been left behind, single words that the two robots utter to each other when they first meet in kind of robotic form, but that's about it. Now, they said that they were imitating the old silent films, and there's a certain nostalgic effect in this. But philosophically, you might also say that it pushes the viewer into a position whereby they're almost forced to take a different kind of attentiveness stance to the one they might otherwise have done. And we could see in the early clip that Wall-E was going along his pathway with the only other animal life form that we see in the whole of the planet Earth, a cockroach on his shoulder. Although it's mimicked, it's not real cockroach sounds, he's attentive to the way the cockroach is sounding, and likewise the cockroach is attentive to him. So it's modelling in a sentimental sort of way a relationship between human robot and animal, both actually sort of marginal forms in some ways, or displaced forms of humanity, and it's sensitising us to communication between them. Now, you might say that this is an old Disney trick. You know, how many Disney characters can you think of that have animal sidekicks, you know, from Pocahontas through to Jiminy Cricket and so on? But this cockroach, Hal, is no Jiminy Cricket. This really looks like the cockroach that goes across your kitchen floor. Well, not your kitchen floors, obviously, but the imagined kitchen floors that, where you've let it go a bit loose. And the cockroach itself is perhaps an interesting focus here. It's not an obviously alluring or cute little animal, and it's made very cockroach-like, isn't it? It's not anthropomorphized in the way that many of the figures are. It's as close to a cockroach as you'd want animation to put it, really. And cockroaches, in biological terms, are another interesting creature. We think of them in disgusting sorts of ways. They are other to us in a way in which we don't want to embrace them imaginatively normally. So, you know, the film, as it were, is asking us to re-see things in a different way that we'd normally see as repulsive and definitely not like us. Cockroaches have also, they're the great survivor species. They've been around on Earth for 300 million years. That's 300 times as long as human beings have. So, respect. we we might feel a little humble in relation to that. If we're still here in another 299 million years' time, yeah, we'll think we've done an achievement, which is we just about got up to cockroach standard. So, you know, there are ways in which the film, as it were, plays with ideas figures that make us rethink something about our own position. This is about as attentive as you can get, really, isn't it? This stance. He's gone down to cockroach level, and there's an element of a sort of equality that's in there. In fact, in the film, he's just run over the cockroach with his caterpillar tracks. And the film evokes an element of real cockroaches, which, as anyone knows who's tried to squish one, they're one of the most unsquishable insects on planet Earth. They seem to lie down and squash themselves out flat like that, but in fact their carapaces allow themselves to go like pancakes and then get up and be perfectly all right at the other end of it. They're virtually indestructible to the squish technique. And the film sort of plays on that kind of comically. Wally's very worried about his cockroach friend. The cockroach looks like it's playing dead and will then get up a moment later. Okay, so that's another dimension then. This film, as it were, whether consciously or not, has absorbed some of our current cultural anxieties about our position with respect to the Earth, not just in a straightforward and simple parable, you know, but in multiple sorts of dimensions. And here's another close-up of the cockroach. And this is a quote from Timothy Morton. It just says, "Ecomimesis," that is, art forms which are mimetic, which try to imitate, as it were, elements of an ecological understanding, involve a poetic of ambience. That is, they evoke particularly the relationship between the subject and a whole surrounding. They're very interested in that, not just the subject as being a goal-orientated figure at the centre who ignores the surroundings. They're very surrounding-orientated. And again, this sense of space that we started with is also very surrounding-orientated. Wally and the shallow focus through an imitation of an old-fashioned anamorphic lens that the film reproduces makes us kind of aware of that, of how we select bits within the environment around us and focus in on that, but then move out, as it were, to seeing the whole. This is the life form that Wally discovers on Earth. So there's another bit of this multidimensionality. This is a marvellous quote from an American film writer, again, a sort of philosopher film writer. Well, I guess he's primarily a philosopher, but he's one of the great writers about film. And he says something which I'd never thought about before, but which I think is relevant to Wally. He says, "My feeling is rather that we have forgotten how mysterious things are, and in general, how different things are from one another, as though we had forgotten how to value them. This is, in fact, something movies teach us." I'd never thought that movies taught us something about things before. I thought they gave us kind of melodramas, which were about ourselves, reflected back. But it opens up a new way of examining it. And it's true, of course, that things often feature in films in ways that do force us to re-examine them. They become part of plots. I guess that's part of what Cavell has in mind here. In terms of environmental consciousness, it also opens up another dimension, I think. When we say nature or the environment, we often think purely about a relationship with animals and plants and so on, and the earth as soil. But our relationship with things is also important. If things are primarily commodities for us, we value them for a short period of time while their commodity allure is with us, and then we throw them away as having no value. That's how the rubbish tips develop. If we look at things differently, if we find new meanings in them, if we reinvent ourselves in relation to them, then we've opened up a whole other channel of consciousness. And some people would argue that our machine-thing axis is as important to consider as the way that we situate ourselves as human beings in relation to animals and plants and so on. This is a thing which is picked up and re-examined by the two robots, an old-fashioned cigarette lighter with a flame that acquires an almost poetic significance as it's lit up. And of course the symbolism of flame works through in that. But you can see from the clip of the film you know, Wally is picking up hubcaps and so on, looking at them again, saying, oh, this is interesting. I can make it into a hat like a child does. This is a playing with things, a kind of sense rediscovering not only their mystery, their wonder, but also their multipleness. They're not just one thing. They've got potentiality to be lots of different things in relation to us, a fake hat in a childlike imagination sort of way. And another quote by Cavell, how do we stop determining ourselves? How do we replace anxious wakefulness by a constant awakening? How do we replace anxious wakefulness by a constant awakening? Now, some people would argue that it's a constituent of human experience and identity in modernity, perhaps particularly late modernity, that, as it were, we're encouraged to think of ourselves in terms of the way that we determine ourselves all the time. We're constantly advised that we should develop ourselves as individuals. We're almost like a project, you know, that we've got a goal, as it were, to who we want to be through education, through acquiring goods and so on. And we're encouraged to remake ourselves according to that goal, determining ourselves. That may seem like a good, and indeed ideologically within modernity, it's often presented as being a good. But Stanley Cavell, as a philosopher, asks us to look at it again from a different angle. What if determining ourselves as an end point of anxious wakefulness in terms of our consciousness, rather than something, as it were, which is more creative, more centered, more spiritual even, which he contrasts with constant awakening, the capacity of our relationship to the world to generate new thoughts and feelings in us at quite a profound sort of level, awakening to the world. Perhaps one of the primary purposes of art, and art at its best, is to give us a proxy experience of what it might mean to awaken to new sets of possibilities. And indeed, I would argue that that's what Wally does through the symbolism of dance, especially. This is an image towards the end of the film where the two robots perform a spontaneous rather extraordinary in visual terms, dance with each other in space. You can see their tracks moving around each other with something of the grace and reciprocity that we associate with dance. And the effect of this dance is to awaken the human beings on Axiom who watch it in a sense of wonder to a new set of potentialities between themselves. These two figures both sit watching it, and then they turn to look at each other, not the screen. The dance, as it were, excites a sort of memory in them, something in the past that they suddenly realise that they've lost. The dance becomes a sort of figure of the possibilities, the potentialities of touching, of reciprocal movement round each other, of awareness of each other in different ways, that starts them on a journey of rebellion in Axiom and a recovery of the earth. And these are just a couple of quotes to finish on, which make us think about that motif, that symbolic image of the dance, in a couple of different ways that might relate well to the film. This is Gilles Deleuze. Sorry, I've spelt his first name wrong. I corrected it on my second one. It's got two L's. The dancer or couple retain an individuality as a creative source of movement, that individuality that I talked about in modernity before. But what counts is the way in which the dancer's individual genius, his subjectivity, moves from a personal motivity, from the individual, into a suprapersonal element, something which is bigger than our individual selves, to a movement of world that the dance will outline. A movement of world, beautifully put. And of course, that's exactly the movement which takes place in Wally at the end, a movement to recover world, our world, Earth, from its degenerate state. And repopulate it. Dance is no longer a movement of dream which outlines a world, but now acquires depth, grows stronger as it becomes the sole means of entering into another world, into another's dream or past. And I like that in the sense that this movement is a recovery of a full meaning which is embodied in pastness, but recovered in a way, as it were, which is now different. The image at the end of the film is of machines and animals and plants working reciprocally together not one of those primitive worlds where we just go back to nature and, as it were, are separated from it in terms of the image of farming that takes place. So, in summary then, what I've tried to explore is something about how films or art generally teach us something, and I've tried to promote an idea that, yes, there's a message, and the message may well be a really important one, but within that message and in the form of the film, there are all kinds of other rich dimensions which are also part of the learning that we might do. And in a great film, the potential for that learning is profound, I think. In lesser films, it's still there and it still rehearses some of the anxieties or some of the things that we feel, particularly in our own contemporary age, but perhaps tends to do it at a more slightly more superficial sort of level. But they're still tools for thinking. Okay, and now, it's 1:45, and I've finished exactly on time. So how good is that? Thank you very much, everyone.